Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair. I am Vanity Fair's digital director, Mike Hogan. I'm here with our film critic sitting across the table from me, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And beaming in through our headphones, the great Joanna Robinson, senior writer in the Bay Area. Joanna and I hung out IRL yesterday.
We had breakfast yesterday in an entirely different city.
Just yesterday. Before she had to drive or fly back to San Francisco to the sounds of No More Parties in L.A. by Kanye West.
How were the parties in L.A.? Well, I guess we can get into that.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about the Emmys. We're going to talk about the Emmy scramble surrounding it. We're going to do a Go Big or Go Home where we discuss one of the categories from this year's or I guess next year's Oscars. But first, we want to talk about this new trailer just came out, Passengers. Mm-hmm. Starring two little-known actors no one's ever heard of, Chris Pratt and Jennifer, how do you say her last name,
Richard?
Laurence.
Oh, right. Yeah, sorry, it's French. Yeah.
By Morton Tilden, who directed The Imitation Game.
Hello.
Wow.
You clean up pretty good yourself.
You two look fine this evening.
We're on a date.
Very nice.
Took you long enough to ask. So, why did you give up your life on Earth? We boarded the Avalon with a destination. 120-year hibernation means we'll wake up in a new century on a new planet. But a year ago, everything changed.
Hello?
Do you know what's going on? Nobody else is awake.
I think something went wrong with the hibernation pods. We woke up too soon. 9 years too soon.
This can't be happening. We have to go back to sleep.
We can't.
Aurora, we love you!
There's a reason. We woke up early.
So it's fresh in our minds. It just broke this morning. There's a lot of references going on in this thing. It looks kind of cool. What do you guys think? Richard, what's your first thought?
Well, I remember when they screened footage of this movie back at, it used to be called Show West. Now it's CinemaCon. And the buzz there was like, oh, it's a big action spectacular. It's not an Oscar movie. But based on this trailer, I mean, they're going for big series. They're going for Gravity is the most obvious reference I saw.
Right.
So I don't know. I'm intrigued.
But also...
2001.
Well, 2001. And then my favorite Ridley Scott movie that nobody likes.
Oh, Prometheus.
Prometheus.
Yes.
There's a Prometheus thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
But also...
The Shining.
The Shining, right? The bar is the bar from The Shining.
Yeah, and Michael Sheen, who plays a robot, is dressed exactly like the bartender in the hotel in The Shining. I would love to see a movie where Michael Sheen plays an evil robot who woke them up to murder them through various spaceship ways. I don't know that that's what we're going to see, but that's the movie I want to see. I don't want to see some like romantic epic sweeping drama, which I think is what we might be in for.
The question is, though, do you hire Michael Sheen just to play a robot bartender in a couple scenes? Who knows?
Hi, it's Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
So the setup, let's just take one step back. The setup is... Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence and presumably a whole bunch of other really good looking white people are put to sleep inside these pods. We're familiar with this from all these sci-fi movies now.
Sure.
If you want to travel to a far off planet, you have to be like freeze dried and then thawed when you get there. But they thaw early, 90 years before arrival, so they're kind of like stuck on this ship, and they got to figure out what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's what I'm gathering.
So this movie has been kind of in the works for a long time, and it's gone through a lot of different casting iterations, and I think originally it was Keanu Reeves and Reese Witherspoon, like maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And back then, the kind of like log line was that he wakes up and then needing a companion wakes her up, which is like, oh, real. And my joke, this is back when I was, think I was still writing for Defamer. So that makes it, I was like, oh, so it's about the worst man in the universe.
Yeah. Like, well, no, and I think that might be still what we're seeing, right? Because at the end of the trailer, it's like, there's a reason we woke up early. And I suspect he is going to have to say, I woke you up. And so it's like boy meets girl, boy gets girl. Boy admits he woke her up 90 minutes before their destination.
Right, but this isn't
certain death.
This isn't like the, I asked you to prom on a dare. This is like I ruined your life.
Yeah, but it's such a guy thing. Like the baby's crying. Could you get up because I don't know what to do. So Joanna, I want to ask you about this because that seems like a generational changing of the guard. If only 4 or 5 years ago this was going to be Keanu and Reese, and now it's Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt. We know how huge Jennifer Lawrence is. How huge is Chris Pratt? Is Chris Pratt just like the hugest movie star in America now, who's a guy or what?
He was huge after Guardians of the Galaxy, and then he did Jurassic World, which was like the movie that ate the world, you know? So like, he is. And the thing that I lament most, I mean, I don't mean to be completely negative about this trailer. There's a lot of good in it, but I love funny Chris Pratt. And I am sort of sad we keep seeing smoldery Chris Pratt, you know, square jaw, handsome leading man Chris Pratt. He's definitely very beautiful and did all the sit-ups in the world to get those abs, so good for you. But does that mean you can't be funny too? You know, you've got so much charm and charisma between these two actors, and at least what they're showing us in the trailer is a lot of angst and drama.
But why does Hollywood do that to people who are funny and charming? Why does it over time set up the incentive so that they become kind of more and more sculpted and less amusing? I almost don't think it's that bad. I just find it fascinating that there's something about the movie star. It's like, you're not funny. You're not the class clown. You're the hero, and you have to not be bending over backwards to crack people up.
You can be witty and kind of cute, but you're not just outright.
You need
comedian.
The charm.
You're not a clown. Yeah.
You need to win us over.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, I think that an interesting sort of way station in the Chris Pratt career is coming up with Magnificent Seven, because he's kind of marrying both smoldery and funny.
He's really good in that too, and has that. Yeah, he's
got so both I think going that on. Like so, but I think that in terms of why a funny actor gets famous and then maybe tries to do some serious stuff, I mean, they obviously want to experiment and try new things, but I think there also is this hard sort of wired narrative in Hollywood that in order to have the top tier respectable movie career, like mega star, you have to kind of be known to do all things. But if you're doing all things, you know, everything gets a little diluted. So you're never like 100% this or 100% that, funny or serious or whatever. So I think he's kind of on that. I think what's interesting about Chris Pratt is that it went really quickly. You know, that progress seems to have happened between 3 or 4 movies, not 10.
Well, when Keanu was set for this role, he was presumably 30 pounds overweight in Parks and Rec, playing like the doofy moron.
The thing that strikes me about this film more broadly is that I feel like if you're going to do a movie about someone lost in space, you really need all the charisma you can muster, right? You've got Matt Damon or Sam Rockwell and Moon. You know, if you've got someone just sort of banging around alone or just a two-hander, you just need that charisma to fill the antiseptic sort of space. I just hope that Morton Tilden is going to use all the tools that these two actors definitely have. I just don't see that in the trailer, but, you know, trailers can be deceiving. So.
Well, right. So there is something, especially in that opening scene where you've got the robot delivering the date request.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Where you're expecting J-Law being J-Law to like shut him down or something. You're like, wait, she's just saying yes and they go on the date? I don't know.
It looks like a Samsung ad. It's like filmed in a very particular way.
We expect edge from both of these people. That's why we fell in love with them in the first place.
Right. I mean, my guess is that scene is way further in the movie than the trailer suggests. But I wonder if we can learn anything from Tilden's previous film, The Imitation Game, which, you know, was a very sort of Weinstein Oscar play with a huge Oscar campaign behind it. And I think, was Keira Knightley nominated as well as Cumberbatch? I think she was. Okay. So he's yielded results in the Oscar sense, but, you know, fairly recently. So I'm wondering, Joanna, does this look at all Oscar-y to you?
Maybe for like visuals or something like that, but I doubt for performance. You know, the reason Morton Tilden's name sticks in my mind so firmly is the year he was nominated for Best Director was controversially the year Ava DuVernay was sort of skipped over for Selma. Maybe it's unfair to compare, but when people were lamenting her absence, someone's like, well, fine, who would you get rid of? And I think most people were like, Morton Tilden, because The Imitation Game had a great performance by Benedict Cumberbatch, I think, but generally felt more subdued than what I think we wanted from that movie. Just a little, almost TV to me. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, that movie was a very nice like miniseries. It didn't quite feel like as big and cinematic maybe as they wanted it to.
I did a... Well, okay, it was a stacked audience, but I did a Q&A with the whole cast, actually, which was, talk about stressful, there was like 12 people on stage, and I had already seen the film, and I liked the film, it wasn't one of my favorites of the year, but it was, I thought it was good, but it absolutely killed in that audience. Again, people are like excited because they're going to see Benedict Cumberbatch and Keira Knightley afterwards, but I think that, you know, we can be frustrated as film lovers that certain kinds of movies keep getting nominated that may not be our favorites, but that was a complete fastball down the middle Oscar movie. Do you know what I mean? Like it hit, it did everything it needed to do as a Best Picture nominee.
Wait, are you saying that the Academy likes World War II movies?
What?
I don't period dramas? Like it hit all of its marks, you know? And I enjoyed it kind of more than I expected to, while I'll admit that there were other movies I was more emotionally invested in. So we'll see. This looks competent.
Hey, you know, if nothing...
He's the very competent Morton Tilden.
Yeah, if nothing else, in a season of serious, heavy drama and then big spectacle, like this seems like maybe a nice middle ground coming out. You know, I would take my parents to see this over Christmas.
Yeah.
You know,
so... And if I were going to be stuck on a spaceship facing certain death, J-Law and Chris Pratt, that's a good pair
and
of people to do
Michael
that
Sheen.
With.
Michael Sheen. Oh, half of Michael Sheen.
Half of Michael Sheen.
I'm coming for half of Michael Sheen. but it's the bottom half. It's the robot.
It's the robot, exactly.
And the Emmy goes to Rami Malek, Mr. Robot.
Okay, so we have to talk about the Emmys. And I'm excited to talk about the Emmys because I got to go to the Emmys and Joanna and I got to do a panel talking about our predictions, some of which panned out quite nicely. And then there were a bunch of parties afterwards. So there's lots to discuss in terms of actual just funny stories like meeting the whole Travolta family and things like that.
Wow.
But let's start with the awards. Joanna, you wrote a wonderful piece that was one of the most popular things on the site in the last week, normal for you, about Rami Malek. Let's talk about Rami Malek. You had mentioned this before on the show, but to you, that seems like a real changing of the guard for Best Actor, huh?
It does. Rami was a favorite to win. So me predicting he was going to win wasn't any sort of stroke of genius. But I think the larger narrative of...
Although he seemed surprised, didn't he? He seemed kind of like shocked.
Well, he's an actor.
That's true. That's a very good point.
I keep watching the GIF of the moment where it was announced because Odenkirk, knowing he wasn't going to win, just took the opportunity to turn to camera and say, hi, Mom. It's pretty cute. so if you watch the GIF of Rami Malek going like, oh, my God, over in the other corner, Bob Odenkirk's like, hi, Mom. some people were questioning it because season two of Mr. Robot was probably more missed than hit. But I think Rami Malek's performance throughout both seasons, both the good and the bad of that show, has been consistent and consistently sort of electrifying. Whether or not you see this as a huge departure from the white male antiheroes who have dominated the category, like I said, with the exception of Kyle Chandler in Friday Night Lights, who's just a hero, I do. I see a very skewed worldview from this character versus the worldviews we've been seeing from our lead actors in a drama for a very long time. You can call his character an antihero, but he's not the kind of antihero we've seen before. And I think Malek made a similar sort of comment in his speech where he's like, you know, this is for the Elliots of the world. We're all a little bit Elliot. And it's true. Like, this is a really isolated, weird, mentally ill character. And so for that to be celebrated by the Television Academy, I think really speaks to the way peak TV, to use an FX term, has opened up the various perspectives that we see on our television screens. So you get Aziz Ansari up there for writing a story that's just a very personal him story about his parents and his writing partner, Alan Yang, his writing partner's parents. You know, so you're seeing the Academy celebrate these very off the usual Emmy beaten path worldviews.
I play a young man who is, I think like so many of us, profoundly alienated. And The unfortunate thing is, I'm not sure how many of us would want to hang out with a guy like Elliot. But I want to honor the Elliots, right? Because there's a little bit of Elliot in all of us, isn't there?
Richard, what did you think of the speech? Because I went to the bathroom and got locked out of the auditorium during it, so I didn't actually witness it.
I thought it was nice. I think that as sort of critically popular as Mr. Robot is, I doubt that a ton of people in the audience were that familiar with the show. So I think him kind of referencing this character and sort of saying this is for all of them, I think a lot of people were like, I don't know what that means.
You mean the audience at home?
The audience at right. home, yeah. Mm-hmm. We're just like, I don't know. No, I thought it was good and I was happy. It was just nice to see something kind of new. You know, the Emmys have had historically a problem with just giving the same things over and over again to the same people. So this felt good.
I feel like I keep saying Changing of the Guard. This is the Changing of the Guard episode. But it felt to me like there were a lot of edgy wins, a lot of people winning for the first time. I think you referenced the Jimmy Kimmel's joke about, you know, maybe there's too much diversity. Right. Obviously, there could never be too much diversity. But do you think that, was that voting rules? Is that like, are we at some kind of inflection point in entertainment? What's going on? Does anyone have any thoughts on what's going on?
Well, I think you can't ignore the impact that the Oscars So White campaign would have, where voting members of any academy is like, we don't want to be pegged as hashtag So White. I don't think that means necessarily that they would vote for someone they don't think is qualified. I just think they would have that in their mind.
More conscious of it, which might affect your thinking, at least. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But also, you know, without question, the biggest show of the year, I think, well, depending on your definition of biggest, People versus OJ had built into it, because it's so much about race in America, had built into it all these great performances by non-white actors, which is where you get a lot of the diversity in wins and nominations in this year.
And I just was so heartened that the people that I was hoping would win actually won, even though the people I was afraid would beat them in classic old-timey Hollywood way were also nominated alongside them. But they still gave it to Sterling and Courtney, and everybody involved seemed to know that that was right and be thrilled about it, you know?
Yeah.
And then Sarah Paulson, you know, she's an edgy person in her own right, you know? And so
she's
for
not
the
straight
three
person.
Of them,
well,
exactly.
Yeah.
So for the three of them to be up there and celebrate it, and certainly I felt incredibly excited about that show. I just felt, I don't know why I felt so personally invested in that show, but I feel like a lot of people did. There's something about it, you just wanted to see it win.
I think it has something to do with the kind of 20-year history of it.
Yeah.
It was like when we were all younger. It just feels very close to the bone. I mean, there's a far vaster landscape on television. The Emmys have many more categories than the Oscars do. But I think that what this year's Emmys prove, to hopefully to the Academy, to the movie industry, is, if you actually create good, diverse content,
right,
you can award that content diversely. And, you know, I mean, it's not that hard to give Sterling K. Brown or Courtney B. Vance or Regina King or Rami Malek or Sarah Paulson awards when they're doing really good work, because they were given the work to do. So hopefully everyone can take that as a lesson. I mean, the same way that the Tonys showed it in June, where like all four acting winners were not white, you know?
Yeah. And it's funny because when Grease Live beat Beyonce, I jokingly tweeted, you know, we live in a world where Grease Live beat out Beyonce for an award. And a bunch of people were like, oh my God, this makes me worried about Trump. And I was like, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
But also the whole message of the show to me was like, even if Trump ekes out a victory, we do not live in Trump's America, right? This is a country that is only getting more diverse. The voices that are being heard and celebrated are only getting more diverse. You can sign up with that little group of angry people who don't like the way this is going, but it's going, you know? So enjoy it. It was fun. It was a fun thing to be part of.
Well, I just do want to say, in defense of Grease Live, Tommy Kail, who directed that, as much as I didn't like a lot of Grease Live, I really admire the directing job he did with it. Tommy Kail of Hamilton fame. So, you know, he did a great job engineering that. I mean, whether or not it touches Lemonade, I can't tell you.
No, I think, I mean, I'm just going to come out and say it. Grease Live was a much more impressive feat of television direction than Lemonade was. As beautiful as Lemonade is, that's, you know, it looks like a lot of ads or a lot of movies. It looks great, but like Grease Live was such a vast, moving, many-part machine that, give it to that guy. I mean, he did a great job.
Yeah. And the people there voting know how hard that is, you know?
Right. Exactly. It doesn't mean I like Grease Live more than Lemonade at all. It's just like as a directing thing.
Hold up, they don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you.
So you guys mentioned that you did this predictions panel and everything like that. Is there any prediction that you got right that you're particularly proud of? Or is there one that you're like, can't believe you got wrong?
You know, Joanna, tell me if you agree with this. The person who gets bragging rights is Josh, who was totally on the Tatiana thing, and we were all didn't dare to think that she was going to win.
Yeah.
Josh was just Josh. Like, no, Tatiana's going to, I think
he just sensed
it
in the air or something.
Yeah, he called it. He called that, which I think was a long shot.
Yeah, he talked to her on Saturday. So there's a great interview with her up on VF.com. And I didn't think it was going to happen. I mean, that's another story of the evening is genre. I mean, Game of Thrones winning last year did a big thing for getting genre television on there. But, you know, Tatiana won for a sci-fi show. Mr. Robot is kind of a sci-fi show. It's a post-apocalyptic show at any rate. You know, so there's a lot of genre television being celebrated. I'll give myself, as gauche it may be, a little bit of credit for for calling Dame Maggie Smith, you know, for calling that the three Game of Thrones actresses would cancel each other out and Dame Maggie Smith would win. So everyone no way.
The air came out of the room at that moment. People were just shocked, frankly.
Yeah. Well, you especially something that Kimmel had made
that
up. Long bit.
Yes.
Like that added to this thing and it's like, motherfucker, like again?
And he came out and took it.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like they knew because those presenters then went on to present another category. Right. So I feel like they were just like, let's do this as a bit and then move on. And I almost feel like Lena Headey knew and that's why she didn't show up. She's like,
oh, it's possible.
You know,
yeah, maybe she was
know.
Having tea with Maggie in England. One thing about the Tatiana Maslany thing, speaking about kind of like, tweeted reactions, was someone on Twitter when she won said, oh, so the Academy finally got around to watching the first season of Orphan Black. And, you know, because like, you know, we're talking about Rami Malek winning for a lackluster season of a great show. You know, arguably Orphan Black has sort of declined in quality since season.
You know what else? Ben Mendelsohn for
Ben
Bloodline.
Mendelsohn.
I mean, that was
totally.
Such a... And I was like, wait, that's for season two.
Yeah, yeah.
He's amazing in season one. Give him all the Emmys.
He should have won an Oscar for that. Yeah, it's a big cruise ship of an Academy. Like, and getting it to notice something is pretty hard, and sometimes it takes a couple
seasons.
There's
so much stuff to watch, you know?
Yeah. Well, speaking of also kind of the Academy being big and slow, with Julia Louis-Dreyfus now winning 5 in a row, historic for a wonderful performance on Veep, can we just make her not eligible anymore? Like, is that possible? Or should that have happened 3 Emmys ago?
Although I will say her acceptance speech was really something else. But, you know, primarily because she just suffered this personal, you know,
anyone had really known about. Like,
no. And I don't know if you could see on TV, but you could see on the big screens in the room, so presumably it's the same crop, that her hand was shaking from the beginning.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is your 5th one in a row. Why is she nervous? But she kind of hinted at it early in the speech, saying, Richard Plepler, you've been so great, especially in this past week. And you think, what's going on?
Yeah.
And as she was walking off, you could see, I think she really just got totally overcome by emotion as she was walking off the stage. That was something. But yeah, I'm sure even Julia Louis-Dreyfus would be like, it's fine. Like, where am I going to put these things?
Right.
At some point.
I mean, I think I know who Richard would have wanted to win in that category, which is probably Laurie Metcalf, is my guess.
That is correct, yes.
But I'm curious, Mike, between Ellie Kemper in Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Tracee Ellis Ross in Black-ish, Amy Schumer inside Amy Schumer, and Lily Tomlin in Grace and Frankie, who would you want to take it over JLD?
Can I give it to Laurie Metcalf?
Yeah,
sure can. Sure.
Please do.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
I think, and I don't watch Getting On, so that's my bad, but like, I would be rolling my eyes a little harder at Veep if it hadn't survived the changing of the guard between Armando Iannucci and David Mandel as showrunner. I thought this season was going to be garbage because, sorry, that's too harsh, but like, you know, I was really worried because Armando Iannucci is such a strong voice, and I was like, why are they going to do more Veep when their strongest voice is leaving? And I thought this season was better than ever. So, you know, for that alone, I'm okay with her taking home her 900th Emmy.
That's also valid, and then also a reason why when they won at the end, it was actually meaningful. You know, we shot a video with Matt Walsh at the White House for White House Correspondents' Dinner with Funny or Die a few months ago, back in the spring, and he was talking about that just informally, so I don't want to say anything that he doesn't want publicized, but all he was saying was that, you know, when they all had to go to Baltimore or whatever, it was like being on a college campus. Like, they spent all of their time just with each other, hanging out, having fun. And now that they can do it in LA, it's more like a regular job and they commute and they have their own lives. And he said, in many ways, it's much better because you can be with your family and have your life. But that's a big difference. And I'm sure that helped the show, that immersiveness of everyone being there in one place. So it is totally cool that they managed that transition. And even in like the opening montage or something, there is something so sharp about the writing of that show.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it just stands out from everything else. They really are.
Well, I mean,
it's a special show.
Not to kick a once top seeded show and it's slightly down, but like in that opening bit with Kimmel trying to get to the Emmys, when you have Modern Family doing its, you know, oh, cutesy thing, and then Veep right after, you're like, oh, man, that's such a sharper show.
Yeah.
So aside from the show, you guys were there for the lead up and then VF co-sponsored a party. Tell me about that stuff. Anything stand out?
Well, we had this great party that we co-hosted with FX. It was a lot of fun, and we had everyone from People vs. OJ, Fargo, The Americans. We had Louis Anderson from Baskets. Just a really great group of people there. Justin Bishop took pictures of everybody with this incredible set with old TVs, and everyone should just look at those pictures. The funniest one, I think, is Cuba Gooding Jr., but Sarah Paulson, I got to be in there when she walked in, and she just climbed right up on top of one of the things and immediately did this totally badass pose.
Regal
pose. She knew exactly what she wanted out of that picture, and it was something to watch. I mean, she is just in the zone. And you can tell it's not easy, you know, to do that. And on her way out, she's like, oh, just one more day of this. And I couldn't help it. Like, who am I to say it? But I was just like, you know, you got to enjoy this while it's going. She's like, I know, I know. But, you know, it's stressful. It's a nightmare. She knew what was coming, but like, I'm sure there's stress. Like, what if I don't get it? I'll be so embarrassed. Everybody's saying I should get it.
Yeah. She said as much on the red carpet. She was like, I just feel like I'm going to let a lot of people down if I don't. Because Juliana, of course, was like, you're the favorite twin. And it was like, oh, Juliana, don't.
And until you go up there and accept that thing, you can't really enjoy this moment that's supposed to be your moment, because you don't know. Right. You could be humiliated, really.
And then she gave a great speech when she did win. I love what she said about Marsha Clark and said, I'm sorry for judging you incorrectly, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I just class act the whole way through.
She was so lovely, but just kind of seeming overwhelmed. She started crying. A bunch of people started crying at that party, actually. Louis Anderson started crying. But she started crying because we told her that every single People versus OJ actor we talked to, and this is true, Cuba, Travolta, Sterling K. Brown, every single one of them we asked what they wanted from Sunday night, and they were like, for Sarah to win. Like, everyone. Yeah. That was the momentum of that party. And I talked to some Fargo people, too, and Fargo got shut out, and it's just too bad because these two great network miniseries battling each other. And so I was asking Bokeem Woodbine, who's one of the nominees, so good in season 2 of Fargo. And he was just talking about how much, I mean, they say, oh, it's a pleasure to be nominated. But, you know, Bokeem Woodbine went from being a name people didn't know to being in the new Spider-Man book. So he's like, I've already seen the benefit of being in this show. And then he gave me this great, weird, esoteric Fargo-esque metaphor where he was like, you know, if you're hunting buffalo, you want to be the one to kill the buffalo. But the truth is, whoever kills a buffalo, we're all going to eat. Just talking about the FX brand and how much they stood to gain from that evening. And it's true. I mean, Fargo got shut out, but FX, like the stars, continues to be on the rise. And I'm not just saying that.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that with him, Bokeem Woodbine, too, it's like he was kind of big in the 90s and then he came back and now he's back with this Fargo role. Like, I think there was a lot of that exciting kind of energy in the room where you're right, Joanna, that people were just really genuinely happy to be nominated. And it was because it was for weird, difficult work that somehow just struck a chord. I'm sure that the mood at the party was good for that reason. And I enjoyed looking at the pictures from afar. I mean, I was at a wedding, so it's not like I was just sitting at home. I was giving a toast at a wedding, but...
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Yes, so that was a cool event. And then afterwards, the governor's ball was interesting. I got to talk to John Travolta a bit, who was very sort of charming and happy to chat. And what he said to me was, I'm just savoring this whole thing. He goes, I am old enough to know how rarefied, as he put it, this type of thing is. Like, these don't come along very often. And I said to him, because I was walking in with Jeffrey Toobin, and Jeffrey Toobin, who wrote the book The People vs. O.J. is based on, and his wife said to me, you know, I don't know, I got to see a little part of this. Seems like a fun way to make a living. And I said to her, I think it's fun when it works, and it's like a nightmare when it doesn't, and it usually doesn't. And I mentioned that to Travolta, and he goes, no, it's 100%. That's how it is. He's like, even with this, we knew it was clicking while we were doing it, but you can never anticipate, you know, if the audience is actually going to like it, if awards voters are actually going to like it. Like, you can't, there's no way to plan for this thing. You know, the network gets nominated for 56 Emmys and everybody wins in their categories and all that stuff. So
yeah,
that was cool. And then who else? I don't know. Then we, you know, we got to go to the HBO party.
I heard almost, that was quite nice. Yeah,
it was. That was a big event. I will admit, I hope my cardiologist isn't listening, that I tried bumming a cigarette from two young women, one of whom turned out to be Sansa Stark. And but they didn't have any. Yeah. But when she turned me down, she said, I wish I had one, but I don't. Alas and alack. Which was very Sansa.
Very cute.
Then I went and almost went up to Ramsay Snow, the actor who plays Ramsay Snow, and said, congratulations, a bunch of people won Emmys for killing you off tonight.
Right.
And then I thought, that's going to upset him. Why? Right. Don't say that to an actor. He doesn't want to be hear something like that.
This is his last dance. I mean, this is it. Yeah. You know.
So I just left him alone to have a nice night,
I think that's fine.
I went home to bed.
So how does this kind of Emmy swirl, like post-parties, all that stuff, compared to the Oscars? How are the moods different?
I think people are having more fun because the stakes don't seem as high.
Right.
You know? There's just something inherently stressful about the Oscars.
Right.
It's like...
And the glory is high, and then the loss is
the fact that
low.
People kind of look at the Emmys being like, it's an Emmy.
Right.
It makes it more, just the whole thing's more fun, you know?
Yeah, it's a really nice thing to get, but it's not
you're
the pinnacle
to get
of your
it,
career
but you're not, yeah. Your Emmy might be a stepping stone to your Oscar. The Oscar's just like, now what? Am I allowed to live, you know?
So. Well, it sounds like kind of the middle tier. I was talking to somebody at Toronto, and they were like, oh, you got to go to the Golden Globes parties. And I was like, well, I mean, why? And he said, because they're all in the same hotel, and you just kind of hop from party to party. And I was like, that sounds amazing.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Plus, I mean, it all sounds fun.
Everyone is like pre-funked at that ceremony, right? So everyone's just primed for a good time.
Yeah.
Any LA thing where you don't have to go from event to event and get stuck? You know, and the
in
police
traffic,
were doing their thing. Like, on the way to the HBO party, the police set up a checkpoint. And so we had to wait for 20 minutes in a line.
Do you think the police just wanted to see Game of Thrones actors?
Totally. So, you know, any way you could just walk from one thing to another would always be good.
Well, it sounds like it was a good weekend. And I thought the show itself was not the most thrilling, but I think a lot of the winners were exciting. So I think that counts for a lot.
And I, as a music snob, I'm really embarrassed that the Hallelujah thing just worked totally on me, the
it
In
really
Memoriam,
did.
And I was very impressed by how they stitched the quotations, the dialogue in with the live music. I was like, wow, I mean, I'm sure she's working with a click track the whole time. Then the New York Times ran this thing this morning being like, Hallelujah, even more than ever, the most overused song in the history of songs.
Right.
And Maura Johnston wrote about this for VanityFair.com in 2010.
Well,
but in the moment, I was just like, this is just beautiful.
I think there have been a few years. I think a peak Hallelujah saturation was a while ago, maybe when Maura wrote about it for us. I don't know. I wasn't hearing the song for the first time, you know, but I was like, still like, oh, this song, you know?
Yeah.
So I felt
she
fine
did
about
a nice
it.
Job. I think she did skip the like really sexually intense lyrics.
Yeah. And there's an interchangeable lyric between, I think, the Jeff Buckley version and the Leonard Cohen version or something where she used one of the softer version. Yeah.
Probably for the best on a family show.
I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do you?
Joanna, any final takeaways from the whole shebang?
Well, you know, if you want to tally up who's the larger winner of the Emmys, you know, HBO and FX each took home 6 awards, which is kind of a big deal for FX, certainly. And Game of Thrones only won 3. I know that sounds crazy to say only, but, you know, they lost all their acting Emmys.
And they were really expected to win 2 acting Emmys, right?
Well, I really did think that the voting rules were going to really hit them with actors competing in the same category. But yeah, that was not the case with People vs. OJ. Those actors competing in the same category still won the award. The last thing I'll say is that it was a big night, not just for FX, but other basic cable programming, because BBC America and USA took home like the big acting awards. Like, that's kind of crazy. So, you know, just to look at how, not to use the phrase again, but peak TV is spreading the wealth beyond HBO, beyond Showtime, beyond the networks to all these other offerings. And Netflix went home with very few. And the big narrative last year was, oh, streaming TV is the future of the Emmys. But, you know, Amazon took home two for Transparent and Jeffrey Tambor. Netflix took home one for Aziz Ansari, one for Patton Oswalt. And I feel like there's one more that I'm forgetting, but pretty low.
Mendelsohn,
there you go. Mendelsohn was sort of a, we don't think that that was quite right, yeah, win. So,
but actually,
and they canceled Bloodline. They canceled one of their like Emmy hopeful shows. So I don't know.
I mean, it's certainly a big night for basic cable, but basic cable that's doing right, the same strategy that the streaming guys are doing is starting to be who made the best choices using the same kind of strategy and the same allocation of resources. This distinction is going away, don't you think?
Well, I disagree. Like, what do you mean by strategy? Because I feel like Netflix's strategy is let's throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. There's a new Netflix show every other weekend, okay, whereas you know, the other ones have a few that they're very carefully putting up, I think. I mean, or BBC America and USA just got lucky with these two actors. But as for FX, you know, I know I sound like such an FX shill, and I really do apologize. But, you know, Landgraf has said we never want more than, I think it's 20 original shows going at once. That's about as much as we can carefully launch and take care of. Whereas Netflix is like, the more content, the better, right? So
yes, I mean, I think there's certainly a difference in volume and, yeah, and probably in how well thought through each thing is. I'm sure Netflix would object to that, but presumably with a certain point of volume, you're not thinking through each thing as much. But the general strategy, which is like the only way to survive in this environment, is to make really distinctive shows that have a point of view with a really strong creator and a, yes, great cast, mm-hmm, which is sadly a relatively recent discovery, right, in the grand scheme of things.
But I wouldn't call that a streaming strategy, because I would source that to shows like, I mean, once again, sound like an FX show, Louis. You know, Louis is one of those things where you give a writer, director, actor sort of full control of their show and launch that very distinct point,
yeah,
of view.
I would say it's a premium cable strategy.
Sure.
That, okay, then migrated to both streaming and to basic cable, as everybody realized, like, if we don't do this, then we're dead, right?
I
like,
think
HBO,
right, yeah,
would have died if it hadn't created The Sopranos. So, what's our Sopranos? Basically, right, everybody, yeah, had to think about.
Right.
And AMC did it with Mad Men, and, you know, take it from there.
So, you're saying next year is Crackle's year?
Probably.
At long last.
Don't count them out. Richard,
yeah,
do you want to take us through,
yeah,
Best Director?
Yeah, we're
going to
do a really quick Go Big or Go Home, because we talked about the Emmys for a long time, as they deserve to be talked about. So because we were talking about Morton Tilden and Passengers and Imitation Game, he was nominated for Imitation Game a few years ago, I thought we could just kind of wildly speculate quickly about who do we think could win, or at least will be nominated for Best Director this year. I'm going to throw out one that I'm very curious about, because the New York Film Festival has just started, and one of the most anticipated films there is Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, directed by Life of Pi and Brokeback Mountain Oscar winner Ang Lee. And so I think that, depending on how that movie plays, I think that he's always a strong shot. The interesting thing about that movie and about its presence at New York Film Festival is that they do not have a press and industry screening for that movie at the New York Film Festival, because, at least this is what I've heard, it's going to be projected in this crazy frame rate, it's shot in this whole new way, this movie, that the projector is so expensive to buy and then to rent and to use that they're not doing a second press and industry screening. So there's just the one public screening of this movie at the festival. So I'm already on the begging publicist for ticket,
wow,
beat. So I don't know. I have no idea what to think about the movie. I talked to some people in Toronto who knew somebody at Fox who'd seen it or something and said it was something, you know. So it's all very shadowy, but I don't know. Never count on Ang Lee, so that's who I'm going to say.
Wow. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Joanna, what do you think?
I'm going to go, my long shot, I guess, is going to be J.A. Bayona for A Monster Calls.
Good call.
Yeah. You know, I think we all think what Damien Chazelle is definitely in there and some other people, but my fingers crossed for that pick.
Well, the person I want to see, it won't be a surprise, is Barry Jenkins.
Right.
I have said already on the show that I think that could be an 8-9 Best Picture, which would mean that he wouldn't make it into Best Director, but it's actually so directorial. and the story is good and people kind of already are aware of the story, that I could see him coming in for Best Director, actually, which would make him a 4-5 or even a 2-3 or maybe a 1.
Yeah. And it just screened yesterday at the New York Film Festival. And, you know, the kind of straggler press, people saw it yesterday. And again, more raves.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thanks for listening to Little Gold Men this week. Please rate and subscribe in iTunes if you love the show, even if you like it. You can also follow us on Twitter. Please do, at Little Gold Men. I'm on Twitter at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S. Mike?
Mike_Hogan.
And Joanna?
Joe Rothen.
Little Gold Men is produced and edited by Alana Milner. Thanks to Laura Mayer and Andy Bowers at Panoply, as always. And this week's award for best description of really anyone's birthday party goes to Joanna Robinson.
She was so lovely, but just kind of seeming overwhelmed. She started crying. A bunch of people started crying at that party, actually.